You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. Lecture 1, given in Dornach on March 21st, 1920. It is quite evident that this course will be able to touch on only a very small portion of our probable expectations with regard to the future of medicine, since you will all agree with me that any real enduring work in this field depends on reforms in the actual education of physicians. Footnote: this course was advertised as a, quote, specialized spiritual scientific course for physicians and medical students, close quote. Personal invitations were sent to physicians and medical students who were members of the Anthroposophical Society. End of footnote. What can be communicated in a course of lectures cannot instigate such reforms, even in the remotest way, except possibly by inspiring a number of people to participate in the reform process. Any medical subject discussed today, however, always has, as its other pole and background, the way people are prepared to work in the field of medicine through their studies in anatomy, physiology, and general biology. This preparation gives the thinking of medical students a particular slant from the very beginning, and this slant, above all else, is what we must get away from. I hope to achieve the educational purpose of these lectures by making the following programmatic divisions in our subject matter. First of all, I will give you a few indications of the obstacles that the modern conventional study of medicine presents to a truly objective grasp of the nature of illness as such. Second, I will indicate where we must look in our search for an understanding of the human being that is capable of providing a true foundation for work in the field of medicine. Third, I will use an understanding of human connections to the rest of the world to suggest the possibilities of a rational system of healing. In this third section, I will answer the question of whether healing is altogether possible and conceivable. Fourth, and I think this may, perhaps, be the most important component of our studies, although it will have to be intertwined with the other three viewpoints, I would like each of you to jot down your special wishes for me on a piece of paper and give it to me by tomorrow or the next day. Please write down whatever you would like to hear about in this course. These wishes can extend to all sorts of topics. What I hope to accomplish through this fourth aspect of the program, which, as I said, will be worked into the other three, is to avoid having you leave this course with the feeling that you have not heard something you particularly wanted to hear. For this reason, I will structure the course in such a way as to work in all the questions you have jotted down. So please give me your requests by tomorrow, or if that is not possible, by this time the day after tomorrow. I think this is the best way to achieve some sort of completeness in the context of this conference. Today, I would like to give only an introduction of sorts, a few observations for purposes of orientation. Above all, I have been making an effort to assemble everything that can be made known to physicians as a result of spiritual scientific research, and I would like to take this as my starting point. I do not want what I am going to attempt here to be confused with a medical course as such, although in fact it is one. We will focus on anything that can possibly be important to physicians, regardless of its origin. A true science or art of medicine, if I may put it this way, can be built up only by taking into account everything considered in the sense I have indicated. I will begin today with a few observations for the sake of orientation. If you have reflected on your task as physicians, you will probably have stumbled frequently over the question of what illness actually is, what a sick human being is. Although explanations of illness and the sick person may be disguised by one or the other seemingly objective insertions, they are rarely anything other than this, that disease processes are deviations from the normal processes of life, that certain phenomena which work on an individual and to which his or her normal life processes are not adapted, produce changes in these normal life processes and in the person's bodily organization, and that illness consists of these change-related functional impairments of parts of the body. You will have to admit, however, that this is nothing more than a negative definition of illness. It is nothing that can help you when you are dealing with actual diseases. This missing practical aspect is what I want to work toward here. To arrive at a definitive view on this subject, I think we would do well to look at certain views on disease that have arisen over the course of time. Not so much because I find this absolutely essential for a modern understanding of disease symptoms, but because we will be able to orient ourselves more easily if we are able to consider the older views that have led to the current ones. You all know that when we consider the origins of modern medicine, we usually point to ancient Greece in the 5th and 4th centuries BC, to Hippocrates. It can be said, or at least we have the feeling, that the view that first appeared with Hippocrates and later led to what is known as humoral pathology, parenthesis, which basically continued to play a role right into the 19th century, close parenthesis, was the beginning of the development of Western medicine. The influence of this belief, which is actually fundamentally erroneous, persists even today and prevents us from achieving an unbiased view of the nature of disease. The first thing we have to do is to eliminate this fundamental error. To an unbiased student, Hippocrates' views, which, as you may already have noticed, continue to play a role right into the 19th century, right up to Rokitansky, constitute not only a new beginning, but also to a very significant extent the end of ancient views on medicine. Footnote: Baron Karl von Rokitansky, R-O-K-I-T-A-N-S-K-Y, 1804 to 1878, professor of pathological anatomy, author of Handbuch der pathologischen Anatomie, 3 volumes, Vienna, 1842 to 1846, apologize for my German, end of footnote. In what comes down to us from Hippocrates, we encounter the last filtered remnant, so to speak, of very ancient views on medicine that were acquired by means of atavistic clairvoyance, rather than by taking the anatomical route, as is done today. The relative position of Hippocratic medicine might be characterized best by saying that it was the point in time when ancient medicine, based on atavistic clairvoyance, came to an end. Speaking superficially, but only superficially, we can say that Hippocratic physicians sought the origin of all disease states in an imbalance among the fluid bodies that work together in the human organism. They pointed out that in a normal organism, these fluid bodies must stand in a definite relationship, and that in a diseased body, their proportions deviate from the norm. Correct proportions were called crasis, C-R-A-S-I-S, and incorrect proportions discrasy, D-Y-S-C-R-A-S-Y. Of course, these physicians looked for ways to influence the imbalance and re-establish the correct proportions. Four components in the outer world were seen as constituting all physical existence: earth, water, air, and fire, although fire was the same as what we now simply call warmth. As far as human and animal bodies were concerned, these four elements were seen as being specialized into black gall, yellow gall, mucus, and blood. It was thought that the human organism needed the right mixture of blood, mucus, and black and yellow gall in order to function. If modern, scientifically educated individuals approach a subject like this, their first thought is that when blood, mucus, and yellow and black gall mingle, they do so in accordance with intrinsic properties that can be determined by means of elementary or advanced chemistry. Seeing it in this light, people imagine this to be the origin of humoral pathology, as if the Hippocratic physicians had seen blood, mucus, and so on only in this way. This was not the case, or rather, it was true of only one of these components, namely black gall, which seems most typically Hippocratic to modern observers. As far as black gall was concerned, Hippocratic physicians did indeed think that its ordinary chemical properties were the active factors. But with regard to all the rest, white or yellow gall, mucus, and blood, they were not thinking only of the properties that can be determined through chemical reactions. They thought that these other fluid constituents of the human organism — for the present I will always restrict myself to the human organism without considering the animal organism — possessed certain intrinsic properties in the form of forces or energies lying outside our earthly existence. Thus, just as they saw water, air, and warmth as being dependent on the forces of the cosmos beyond Earth, they also saw these constituents of the human organism as being imbued with forces coming from outside the Earth. In the course of the evolution of Western science, we have completely ceased looking toward forces that come from outside the Earth. Today's scientists would find it downright peculiar if they were expected to think that water, when it influences the human organism, supposedly possesses not only those properties that can be confirmed through chemistry, but also others it possesses by virtue of belonging to the supra-earthly cosmos. But according to ancient views, the effects of forces originating in the cosmos itself are introduced into the human organism through its fluid constituents. Although the effects of these cosmic forces gradually ceased to be taken into account, medical thought into the 15th century continued to be based on remnants of the filtered view we encounter in Hippocrates. This is why it is so difficult for modern scientists to understand medical texts written before the 15th century. For, it must be said, that most of the authors of that time did not have any real understanding of what they were writing. They talked about the four basic constituents of the human organism, but their reasons for describing these constituents in one way or another were derived from a knowledge that had died with Hippocrates. In talking about the properties of the fluids that build up the human organism, people were simply talking about the after effects of Hippocratic knowledge. Galen, then, contributed a compilation of old traditions that worked on into the 15th century, although they were becoming more and more incomprehensible. Footnote: Claudius Galenus, 129 to 199 AD, Greek physician to the gladiators in Paganum and at the court of Marcus Aurelius, considered the founder of experimental physiology. He demonstrated the function of arteries. He is responsible for about 100 treatises on physiology and medicine. End of footnote. But there were also single individuals, capable of recognizing and pointing to the existence of something whose possibilities are not exhausted by the purely earthly element, by what can be ascertained chemically or physically. These individuals acknowledged the need to point to something in the human organism that makes its fluid substances work in ways other than those that can be confirmed through chemistry. Although others could also be mentioned, these opponents of the prevailing school of humoral pathology included Paracelsus and Van Helmont, who brought a new quality into medical thought in the 16th and 17th centuries, simply by trying to formulate a concept that others were no longer formulating. Footnote: Philippus Aureolus Paracelsus, Theophrastus, Bombastus von Hohenheim, 1493-1541. Swiss physician and alchemist. He investigated problems and diseases related to mining. He was forced out of mainstream medical practice because of his unorthodox ideas and methods. He established a phenomenological approach to medicine and helped to establish chemistry as a part of medical practice. Johann Baptist von Helmont, Van Helmont, 1579-1644, Flemish physician and chemist, who coined the term gas, suggested by the Latin and Greek chaos, to designate aeriform fluids. He was the first to distinguish gases from air, such as carbon dioxide, and considered water a pure chemical, in quotes. He also suggested the use of alkalis to balance acidity in the stomach. End of footnote. Their formulation, however, contained thoughts that could be followed only by those who were still somewhat clairvoyant, as Paracelsus and Van Helmont very definitely were. If we are not clear about all these matters, we will not be able to communicate understandably with each other about certain remnants that still cling to modern medical terminology, although their origins are no longer recognizable. Thus Paracelsus, and later others who were influenced by him, assumed the archaeus to be the basis of the action of fluids within the organism. Archaeus is spelled A-R-C-H-E-U-S. He assumed the archaeus to be similar to what we speak of as the human etheric body. The term archaeus, as Paracelsus uses it, and human etheric body, as we use it, actually sum up something that does not indeed exist, but without tracing its actual origins. Doing so would oblige us to proceed as follows. We would have to say that the human being has both a physical organism, which consists essentially of forces that work out of the earth, and an etheric organism, which consists essentially of forces that work out of the periphery of the cosmos. And there's a drawing. Our physical organism is a portion of the entire organization of the earth, as it were. Our etheric body, and also Paracelsus's archaeus, is a portion of something that does not belong to the earth, something that therefore works into the earthly element from the cosmos from all directions. Thus, in his view of an etheric organism underlying the physical organism, Paracelsus summed up everything that had been described earlier as simply the cosmic aspect of the human being, a concept that came to an end in Hippocratic medicine. Although he indicated details here and there, he did not investigate further into the supra-earthly forces connected to what was at work in the archaeus. We might say that Paracelsus's meaning has become ever more incomprehensible. This is especially evident if we jump forward into the 17th and 18th centuries, where we encounter Stahl's school of medical thought, which no longer understood anything of how the cosmic aspect works into the terrestrial. Footnote, Georg Ernst Stahl, 1660 to 1734, an advocate of animism. End of footnote. Stahl's school of medicine enlisted the help of all sorts of unfounded concepts, concepts of a life force, of life spirits, and so forth. Whereas Paracelsus and Van Helmont still spoke with some degree of consciousness about what lay between the soul spirit and the physical organization of the human being. Stahl and his followers spoke as if it were simply a matter of another form of the consciousness soul playing into the structuring of the human body. Of course, Stahl's view elicited a strong reaction, because anyone who carries on in this way, hypothesizing about some sort of vitalism, is entering the realm of purely arbitrary constructs. And, as you know, the 19th century then rose up in arms against these arbitrary constructs. It can be said that only very great minds like Johannes Müller, who died in 1858 and was the teacher of Ernst Haeckel, managed to overcome some of the harm that resulted from this unclear way of speaking that addressed life forces as if they were soul forces at work in the human organism, but had no clear idea of how they were supposed to work. Footnote, Johannes Peter Müller, 1801 to 1858, a German physiologist and comparative anatomist, Ernst Heinrich Philipp August Haeckel, 1834 to 1919, became professor of zoology at the University of Jena. He was a prolific writer, and by the age of 60 had published 42 works. End of footnote. At the same time, however, a totally different trend was emerging. We have traced the declining trend to its last vestiges, but more recent times saw the dawning of an idea that then became definitive in a different way in terms of the formulation of medical concepts, especially in the 19th century. Basically, this idea was derived from a single, unusually authoritative 18th century work. The Latin is De sedibus et causis morborum per anatomum indagatis, 1761, translation, On the Bases and Causes of Diseases Through Anatomical Investigation, by the Paduan physician Morgagni. Footnote, Giovanni Battista Morgagni, Morgagni, 1682 to 1771, Italian physician and considered the founder of pathological anatomy. End of footnote. This book saw the emergence of a totally new view that essentially introduced the materialistic trend into medicine. We need to characterize these things completely objectively, without sympathy or antipathy, because what came to light in this book directed people's attention to the consequences of disease in the human organism. Autopsy became definitive. Only from this time onward can it be said that autopsy became definitive. It was possible to tell from the corpse that if a certain illness, regardless of what it was called, was present, a particular organ must have undergone a specific change. These changes began to be studied during post-mortem examinations. This practice constitutes the actual beginnings of pathological anatomy, while everything that had previously existed in the field of medicine was based on certain persistent effects of ancient clairvoyance. It is interesting to note how this great shift finally took place in one fell swoop. Interestingly enough, it is possible to point precisely to the two decades in which this transformation came about, when any remainders of the ancient legacy were abandoned and the atomistic and materialistic view of modern medicine was established. If you take the trouble to read through Rokitansky's Handbook on Pathological Anatomy, published in 1842, you will still find traces of the old humoral pathology, remnants of the view that disease is based on the abnormal interaction of fluids. Rokitansky very ingeniously incorporated this view, which can be maintained only by legatees of the old view of the supra-earthly qualities of fluids, into his observations of changes in organs. Thus his book, although based on post-mortem observations of organ changes, also suggests that particular organ changes came about under the influence of abnormal fluid mixtures. There you have, in 1842, the final appearance of the legacy of ancient humoral pathology. In the next few days, we will talk about how forward-looking attempts, such as Hahnemann's, to consider more comprehensive concepts of disease, were introduced into the decline of the old humoral pathology. Footnote: Christian Friedrich Samuel Hahnemann, 1755 to 1843, founder of homeopathy. His chief work, Organon der rationellen Heilkunde, The Organon of Medicine, Dresden, 1810. End of footnote. Hahnemann's and similar attempts are too important to be presented in a mere introduction and will have to be discussed later in greater detail. At this point, however, I would like to draw your attention to the fact that in the two decades following the publication of Rokitansky's book on pathological anatomy, the foundations were laid for the atomistic, materialistic view of medicine. In a very strange way, old views still played into the ideas that developed in the first half of the 19th century. It is interesting to observe that Schwann, for example, who might be said to have discovered that plants have cells, was still of the opinion that cell formation was underlain by the development of some sort of shapeless fluid he called blastema, B-L-A-S-T-E-M-A, and that the cell nucleus condensed out of this fluid formation, gathering cell protoplasm around it. Footnote: Theodor Schwann, 1810 to 1882, professor of anatomy and physiology in Liège and in Louvain. His chief work was Mikroskopische Untersuchungen über Einstimmung in der Struktur und dem Wachstum der Tiere und der Pflanzen. Again, apologize for my German. Microscopic investigation of the agreement between structure and growth in animals and plants. Berlin, 1839, end of footnote. It is interesting to note that Schwann still posits an underlying fluid element possessing attributes whose tendency to differentiate beings about the cells brings about the cells as such. It is also interesting to trace the gradual subsequent development of a view that can be summed up in these words: the human organism builds itself up out of cells. This idea approximates today's customary view that the cell is a type of building block for organisms, and that the human organism is built up out of cells. At heart, the view that was still evident between the lines, or even more pervasively, in Schwann's work, is the final remnant of the old system of medicine, because it does not lead to atomism. It sees an atomistic phenomenon, cells, as emerging from something that, if considered rightly, can never be thought of as atomistic, namely a pre-existing fluid essence that possesses inherent forces and gives rise to the atomistic element through differentiation. Thus, in the two decades of the 1840s and 1850s, the older, more universal view was coming to an end, and the atomistic view of medicine was dawning. It was fully present by the time Virchow published his book on cellular pathology in 1858, Footnote: Rudolf Virchow, 1821 to 1902, professor of pathological anatomy at Würzburg and Berlin, co-founded the Archive for Pathological Anatomy and Physiology and Clinical Medicine, explained cellular pathology in his Vorlesungen über Zellularpathologie in ihrer Begründung auf physiologischer und pathologischer Gewebelehre. Lectures on Cellular Pathology, Its Basis in Tissue Physiology and Pathology, Berlin, 1859. End of footnote. We must recognize that an enormous leap, an enormous shift in the direction of modern medical thinking took place between the publication of Rokitansky's book in 1842 and Virchow's in 1858. Virchow's book deduces all pathological phenomena in the human being from changes in cellular functioning. Ever since its publication, the ideal official view has been to study changes in cells, in organ tissue, and to understand all illness as resulting from such cellular changes. This atomistic view simplifies matters because it makes them very clear and lays them out in a way that is easy to understand. And more recent science, in spite of all its advances, always aims to understand everything in the simplest possible terms, without considering that it is the character of nature and the cosmos to be extremely complicated. It is very easy to demonstrate experimentally, for example, that an amoeba in water changes its shape, extending and retracting its arm-like processes. Then, if you warm the liquid it is floating in, you will see that its processes extend and retract more quickly, at least until the temperature reaches a certain point. Then the amoeba contracts and is no longer able to respond to changes in the surrounding medium. You can also introduce an electric current into the liquid and observe how the amoeba assumes a spherical shape. It eventually bursts if the current running through the liquid becomes too strong. In this way, the changes an individual cell undergoes under the influence of its environment can be studied and used as the basis of a theory of how disease gradually develops through alterations in the character of the cell. What is the essence of the results of that great shift that took place within two decades? What emerged then lives on and now permeates all of official medical science. It is none other than the general tendency that has developed in the age of materialism, the tendency to grasp the world in atomistic terms. Please take note of the following. I began by drawing your attention to the fact that anyone working in the medical field today is absolutely obliged to consider the question of what diseases are. What kind of processes are they? And how do they differ from the human organism's so-called normal processes? We need a positive conception of this deviation in order to be able to work with it at all. But the usual descriptions supplied by official science are exclusively negative and serve only to point out that such deviations exist. Then attempts are made to eliminate the deviations. But there is still no comprehensive view of the nature of the human being, and our entire philosophy of medicine suffers from the absence of such a comprehensive view. What are disease processes really? You will not be able to avoid calling them natural processes. Suppose you trace the consequences of some external process in nature. It is not so easy to make an abstract distinction between that process and a disease process. You call the natural process normal and the disease process abnormal, without pointing out why the process taking place within the human organism is an abnormal one. You cannot develop practical applications until you can at least explain to yourself why the process is abnormal. Only then can you investigate how to do away with it, because only then will you be able to discover which corner of the cosmos makes it possible to eliminate such a process. Ultimately, even calling something abnormal is an obstacle. For why should any process in the human being be considered abnormal? Even if I cut my finger, that is only abnormal as it relates to the human being, because if I cut a piece of wood into a particular shape, that is a normal process. But if it is my finger that gets cut, I call that an abnormal process. The mere fact that we customarily engage in processes other than finger cutting tells us nothing. It is merely playing with words. From a certain perspective, what happens when I cut my finger follows a course similar to that of other processes. It is just as normal as any other natural process. Our task is to discover the real difference between those processes within the human organism that we call disease processes, which are basically quite normal and normal natural processes, even though specific causes must precipitate them, and the everyday processes that we usually call healthy. We must discover this radical distinction. But we will not be able to do so if we cannot take up a way of looking at human beings that really leads us to their essential nature. In this introduction, I would like to sketch for you at least the first elements of this way of looking at the human being, with the intention of elaborating on them later. I am sure you understand that in these lectures, which are necessarily limited in number, I will be giving you primarily what you will not find in books or other lectures, and I will assume a knowledge on your part of what is available elsewhere. I do not think it would be especially valuable to present a theory to you in constructs that you could also find somewhere else. For this reason, let us turn now to what you can discover by simply comparing what you can see in a human skeleton and the skeleton of one of the so-called higher apes, a gorilla, for example. If you compare these two skeletons on a purely superficial level, the main thing you will notice in the gorilla is the exceptional development of the entire lower jaw, simply in terms of mass. The lower jaw weighs heavily on the skull. When you look at the head of a gorilla, with its massive lower jaw, you get the feeling that the lower jaw weighs heavily on the entire skeleton in some way, pushing it forward, and that the gorilla makes a considerable effort to remain upright in spite of this burden. You will find the same distribution of weight, in contrast to the human skeleton, when you look at the gorilla's forearms and the lower part of the hands. They seem heavy. In the gorilla, everything is massive. In contrast, in the human being, everything is refined and delicately joined. Weight moves into the background in the human being. In these particular parts of the body, the lower jaw and the forearms and fingers, the element of weight moves into the background in the human being, while it is prominent in the gorilla. Anyone who has cultivated a sharp eye for these proportions will be able to find them again in the bones of the feet and legs. There, too, an element of weight is present in the gorilla, which is pushing in a certain direction. I will use this line in their diagrams as a schematic indication of the force that can be seen in the gorilla's lower jaw, arms, and legs. In a human being, this force is counteracted by an upward striving element. This conclusion is inevitable if you observe a human lower jaw, which no longer weighs down the skeleton, and the delicate shaping of human arms and fingers. The difference between a gorilla skeleton and a human skeleton is evident to the naked eye. You will have to deduce the form-creating element in the human being from a kind of parallelogram of forces, which results from the same upward force to which gorillas adapt only outwardly, as you can tell by the effort required for them to maintain uprightness. Here is the resulting parallelogram with its lines of force, and again there's a picture. The very strange thing about this is that nowadays we usually restrict ourselves to simply comparing the bones or muscles of higher animals to those of humans, and fail to place enough emphasis on this morphological transformation. In observing it, we must look for one essential aspect. You see, in the human being, the forces that counteract those determining a gorilla's form must actually be present. Those forces must exist. They must be at work. If we look for them, we will rediscover the aspect of ancient medicine that was abandoned or filtered out by the Hippocratic system. You will rediscover that the original forces in the parallelogram are earthly in character. The other forces, however, must be sought outside the earth. They unite with the original forces, and the resultant owes its origin to supra-earthly extraterrestrial forces rather than to earthly ones. We must look for forces that pull human beings into the upright position. This is not the same as the upright position higher animals assume from time to time, because the forces active in bringing about human uprightness are also formative forces. It makes a difference whether we are dealing with apes, who walk upright but still possess forces that weigh them down in the other direction, or with humans, whose skeletal development works in the direction of forces that are non-earthly in origin. If we simply look at the form of the human skeleton in the right way, tracing the dynamics at work in building it up, instead of restricting ourselves to describing the individual bones and comparing them to animal bones, we will realize that what we see there is not to be found anywhere in the other kingdoms of nature. We must unite the specifically human forces with the original forces in the parallelogram. The resultant cannot be accounted for by considering only forces that exist outside the human being. It will be important for us to make a careful study of this leap from the animal to the human. When we do, we will be able to discover the origin of disease in both humans and animals. I can show these elements to you only little by little, but when we pursue them further, we will be able to make many discoveries. In connection with what I have just presented to you, I would like to mention the following. If we move on from the skeletal system to the muscular system, we discover significant differences in the character of muscles. A muscle at rest is alkaline in reaction, if we take its typical chemical effect into account. But we can actually say only that its reaction is alkaline-like, because in a resting muscle, the reaction is not as clear-cut as alkaline reactions otherwise are. Similarly, in an active muscle, a somewhat indefinite acid reaction occurs. As you recall, in a metabolic sense, muscles are composed, of course, of what human beings ingest. Therefore, in a certain respect, they are a result of the forces present in earthly substances. But when human beings become active, it becomes increasingly evident that what their muscle tissue contains, as a result of being subject only to ordinary metabolism, is being overcome. The changes appearing in active muscle tissue stand in contrast to ordinary metabolic changes, and can ultimately be compared only to the forces bringing about the formation of the human skeletal system. These latter forces, which transcend what humans acquire from outside, imbue themselves with terrestrial forces, uniting with them to bring about a resultant force. Similarly, we must also see muscle metabolism as containing something chemically active that is working into the earth's chemistry. You might say that in the skeleton, something we can no longer find within the earthly element is working into earthly mechanics and dynamics. Similarly, in our metabolism, we have non-earthly chemistry working into earthly chemistry to produce effects different from those that can appear under the influence of earthly chemistry alone. These observations about morphology on the one hand, and quality on the other, will have to constitute our point of departure if we want to discover what actually lies within the human being. This approach will reopen the way back to something that has been lost but is obviously still needed if we are willing to accept a mere formal definition of disease, if we are not willing to accept a mere formal definition of disease that is useless in actual practice. You see, a very important question is emerging. Earthly remedies from our surroundings are all we have available to work on the human organism when it undergoes changes. Non-earthly forces, however, are at work in us, or at least forces that turn our processes into non-earthly processes. This gives rise to the question of how we can bring about an interaction between the sick human organism and its physical earthly environment, an interaction that leads from illness to health. How can we call forth a reciprocal relationship of this sort that will really also be able to influence those forces active in the human organism that are not encompassed by the realm of processes from which we select our medicines, even if these processes are dietary prescriptions and so forth? You see that what can ultimately lead to a specific therapy is intimately related to an appropriate understanding of the essential nature of the human being. These first rudimentary elements of what is intended to enable us to rise to a solution to this problem have been derived from distinctions between humans and animals. I am fully aware of the very facile objection that animals and even plants can also become ill. Lately there has even been talk of diseases in minerals, and that therefore no distinction should be made between humans and animals as far as illness is concerned. We will deal with this objection later. These distinctions will become evident once you see how little physicians stand to gain in the long run from investigating the animal kingdom with the goal of making headway in human medicine. To be sure, animal experimentation does have something to offer with regard to human healing, and we will find out later why this is so. But only if the radical difference between animals and humans, a difference that persists right into the details of their organization, is fundamentally clear to us. For this reason, it will be important to find appropriate ways to continue to clarify the significance of animal experimentation for the development of the field of human medicine. As we continue, I would like to draw your attention to the fact that when we are obliged to point to such supra-earthly forces, the personality of the individual is involved to a much greater extent than it is if we can always point to so-called objective rules or objective laws of nature. Admittedly, it will be important to work toward the intuitive element to a much greater extent in the field of medicine. We need to realize that an intuition trained to observe forms, the gift of drawing conclusions from morphological phenomena about the character of an individual human organism that may be sick or healthy in some respect, must play an ever greater role in the future development of medicine. As I said, these things were intended to serve only as an introduction and orientation of sorts, because the important point for today is to show that medicine must, once again, turn its attention to something that cannot be accomplished through either chemistry or conventional comparative anatomy, something that can be achieved only if we move on to consider the facts from a spiritual scientific viewpoint. Several errors are still prevalent in this regard. The main issue in the spiritualization of medicine is thought to be replacing material remedies with spiritual ones. This approach may be justified in particular areas, but it is totally unjustified on the whole, because what is most needed is a spiritual recognition of the healing value that may be present in a material remedy. That is, using spiritual science to evaluate material remedies. That will be the task of the portion of this course that I described as searching for healing possibilities by recognizing the connection between the human being and the rest of the world. I want all the things I will say about specific therapeutic processes to be as well-founded as possible, and to help in acquiring a view, in each single illness, of the connection between the so-called abnormal process, which is of necessity a natural process, and so-called normal processes, which are also nothing other than natural processes. I would merely like to add a brief postscript. Whenever the fundamental question has arisen of how to come to terms with the fact that disease processes are also natural processes, attempts have always been made to evade the issue. For example, I was interested to learn that already in the first half of the 19th century, Troxler, who taught in Bern, was very emphatically pointing out that illness needed to be investigated as a normal phenomenon. Footnote, Ignaz Paul Vital Troxler, 1780 to 1866, published works, I'll give you the English, Glimpses into the Essential Nature of the Human Being, Aarau, 1812, Natural History of Human Knowledge or Metaphysics, Aarau, 1812, and Lectures on Philosophy, Its Content, Delineation, Purpose, and Applicability to Life, Bern, 1836. End of footnote. He claimed that this view would ultimately lead us to acknowledge the existence of a certain world that is connected to our world, but forces its way into it through illegitimate channels, as it were, and that the results of such an investigation could have something to do with disease symptoms. I want to touch on this only superficially at this point. Just imagine, however, a world existing in the background whose governing principles are very justified processes that happen to bring about disease symptoms in our world. If that were the case, if these laws that are totally justified in a different world were to break through into our world through certain gaps, they would cause all kinds of damage. This was what Troxler was aiming at. In spite of the fact that he expressed himself without clarity in some respects, it is still possible to see that he was on a path that was leading toward a certain healing for medical science. Since Troxler had lectured at the university in Bern, A friend there once helped me investigate how he was regarded by his colleagues and what came of his suggestions. In the encyclopedia that documents many incidents in the history of the university, we were able to find only that Troxler had been the cause of a great many arguments. We found nothing in particular about his importance to science. As I said, my intention today was only to point out these things. Please do write down all of your wishes for me by tomorrow or the next day, so that I can weave them into what I myself intend to present. The form that these lectures will take will be based on these wishes of yours. I think this will be the best way to proceed. So please, make extensive requests. The end of Lecture 1.